Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. In modern memory, Winston Churchill remains the man with the cigar and the equanimity among the ruins. Few can remember that at the age of 40, he was considered washed up, his best days behind him. In Young Titan, historian Michael Sheldon has produced the first biography focused on Churchill's early career, the years between 1901 and 1915 that both nearly undid him, but also forged the character that would later triumph in the Second World War. Michael Sheldon is the author of four literary biographies, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist Orwell, The Authorized Biography, which was also a New York Times notable book. For 15 years, he was a features writer for the London Daily Telegraph, and for 10 years, he served as a fiction critic for the Baltimore Sun. Michael Sheldon, welcome to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is a delight to have you aboard. What brought you to this to Churchill as a subject, but specifically this chapter in his life?
I was always interested in Churchill. Who isn't? I worked for his granddaughter for a few years. She ran the Telegraph magazine. Like the New York Times, the Telegraph had its own separate magazine, and she was the editor of it. I liked her a lot, found her very interesting. So I thought there ought to be something new to say about Churchill, and it seemed to me this early period of his life when I got into it was just so fascinating because it's the Churchill you don't know. He's slender, he's dashing figure who plays polo, has lots of girlfriends. He's quite a different figure from the man of the 1940s.
And what I assume makes your job interesting, what makes the book work so well, is that there's actually something to say about this period. I mean, it's a fascinating look into him because we see so many connections, and we also see his evolution.
I say in the book that if he had died at 40, he would still be a famous figure. Many people thought he would be prime minister by the time he was 40. He rose through the ranks of his party, just one office right after the other, so that by the time World War I began, not World War II, World War I, he's the head of the British Navy. So when his future nemesis, Adolf Hitler, is a lowly corporal, Churchill's heading the largest navy in the world. So he had quite an impressive life right up until the period where his career collapsed in 1915, when he was blamed for a lot of the early setbacks in the First World War.
I want to talk a little bit about that in a moment, but where did you want to start the story?
I wanted to start it right as the Victorian age ends. We don't think of Churchill as Victorian at all. We don't even think of him as Edwardian. But he was 26 years old when the Victorian age ended, and his real peak of his career early in life was in the Edwardian age, that same age that we see in Downton Abbey, where it's beautiful women and impressive men and with titles who are going back and forth, the House of Lords or the House of Commons. They rule the world. England is the center of the world at that time, with the largest empire of modern times.
So starting there, where was Churchill in his life?
He had just finished a very interesting period where he was a soldier, a war correspondent, and had done so many amazing things in his life, several adventures that he said he joked in old age. He said, I think by the age of 25, I had written as many books as Moses, by which he meant five, because he would write books about his adventures, whether they were in India or in the Sudan, or most famously in the Boer War, where he was captured and taken prisoner. So by 25, he was so famous he could go around the world lecturing. He came to America, he went up to Canada, and I catch him right at the moment my story begins, when he's lecturing on the night that the news comes that Queen Victoria has died, and he knows this is the time to begin his career. And he races back to London, gives his maiden speech in the House of Commons, and he's off and going.
At what point did it become clear of what he could become, of what his career path was going to be, and ultimately about his ambition?
I think he almost came out fully formed. He seems at 25 or 26, in some ways even more impressive than he was at 60, because he has that facility to turn a phrase, he has that ability to speak so confidently. Most people, when they're elected to the House of Commons, wait as many as 24 months or 30 months before they give their maiden speech. He waited 3 weeks. He was so anxious to get going, and he felt prepared, so that as a child of the aristocracy, somebody who had been born into privilege, he assumed he had a destiny ahead of him. He used to say that the stars in their courses guided his career. So he thought somebody was rooting for him up there. He wasn't necessarily religious, but he certainly thought destiny was awaiting him. He didn't realize he would have to wait all the way until he was 60 for his great moment in the sun. But he thought it would come when he was in his 20s and 30s.
And to further that, you portray him as being a surprisingly progressive leader in that time.
He's a liberal. Yeah, he doesn't find much opportunity in the Conservative Party, the party he begins with, and he quickly abandons them, not only because the liberals offer more chances for advancement, but they're the more interesting party at the time. They're starting up what we would today call Social Security and a social safety net. And he finds all that fascinating, and he thinks the age of wars and that sort of thing may be ending, so he wants to get in on the progressive side. It's the same in America with Teddy Roosevelt. When Teddy and Winston met, they didn't get along. In later years, someone asked Teddy Roosevelt's daughter why that was so, and she said, "I think they were too much alike." So he's a lot like Teddy, who's a progressive at the same time as Winston is interested in that kind of philosophy in England.
And you write in the book, and I find this really interesting, about here is a man with an aristocratic background who becomes this champion of the poor, of doing, in his mind, what was right.
Yes, and the upper classes hate him for it. He makes a lot of enemies among his own people. They regard him as a traitor. When he leaves the Conservative Party for the Liberals, he's labeled a turncoat, and he pays a heavy price for that. He, at times, it seems as though most of the upper class are looking for reasons to overthrow Winston as he rises through the government. And when things go bad in the war, they're given that excuse, and they turn on him. But he made a lot of enemies at this time, made a lot of good friends, but also it's surprising how much Churchill, as a young man, was hated because he was seen as a traitor to his class.
The modern relevance to the story is that he was able to overcome a divided government and political gridlock. You certainly mention the opposition that he received from the Conservatives, but he had problems from the left as well.
Yes. On the far left and the far right, he made enemies as fast as he could, because everything he did was geared toward getting things done. He believed so much that, quite apart from philosophy or political expediency or ideology, any of those other things, he just simply wanted to act. And I know today all of us feel that that's what we need in government, somebody who can get things done. And it wasn't just simply that he brought parties together or he brought various people together toward the center. It was because of this magnetic personality he had. In one of his earliest political speeches, he gave this great phrase that I love. He said, "I believe in personality." Mm. And what he meant by that was, above party politics or anything else, you had to be a leader. And leaders are made by their characters. And he believed very much in that.
You have a quote in the book, "Some things government must do, not because the government would do them well, but because nobody else would do them at all."
Yeah, he wasn't an ideologue. He didn't necessarily believe a big government was good, but he also thought if government could help out, that there was no reason you couldn't employ it, that you couldn't put it to work for the people. There were some things, as he says, that simply wouldn't get done if government didn't do them. So he's willing to use government because he believes so powerfully in simply moving ahead, not being stuck in a rut, not turning around in circles as we seem to do today. He wanted to move ahead. And he really gave to the word progressive, he really gave a true meaning, because he wanted so much to keep society improving.
Michael Sheldon is the author of the new book, Young Titan, The Making of Winston Churchill. It is published by Simon and Schuster. You have an opponent in the book calling him a dangerous optimist. How true is that?
He wouldn't give up. You know, he's famous for saying never give up, and he wouldn't simply give up. When three women, one right after the other, rejected his proposals for marriage, he made a fourth proposal. And the fourth proposal worked. But he was the sort of man, whether it was a question of romance or politics or war, simply would not back away. And perhaps it was optimism, but it was also a kind of personal resiliency. And his opponents regarded that as somewhat dangerous because they thought, what do you do with a man who will not go away when he looks defeated? He'll just get up and come at you again. Somebody in the House of Commons one time threw a book at him, hit him in the cheek, and it drew blood. And this was quite a scandal. Mm. And the fellow who did this was 6'6". Winston, who was barely 5'8", went after him. If you can imagine a little man under 5'8" attacking a man who's 6'6", but he wouldn't back down from a fight.
When you consider, and you spend a lot of ink in the biography, not a lot, but a good portion about his romantic life and that early romantic life, and as you indicated, it can tell us a little bit, if not a lot, about his political life as well.
He was a romantic, and he was a romantic in all senses. I think most of us would recognize that there's a touch of romance in his view of England and of the empire and of his part in government. But I found that also to be surprisingly true of his personal life. And it seems as though with icons like this, sometimes we want to pretend they don't have real feelings, that they're not just like the rest of us with yearnings. But he was in love with three of the most beautiful women of the Edwardian period. They were incredible women. One of them was an American, Ethel Barrymore, the actress. It was quite stunning when she was in her early 20s. And he pursued these women aggressively. He wanted, for his career, he wanted a glamorous woman beside him because he saw the world as a kind of stage. And I think with an actress like Ethel Barrymore, he thought she would play the part of his wife brilliantly. She didn't think so. And she was one of the ones who turned him down. But this meant a lot to him.
He is so celebrated in his early career and, as you note, is pretty much thought to be destined to be prime minister before turning 40. One of the most powerful men in all of British government in 1914 and 1915. And then, boy, the tides turn. And he ultimately becomes very quickly a failure. Give us a sense of what happened, how much of this was him being a scapegoat, and ultimately how he was overcome it.
I think this story is important for all of us because we all have our moments where things just go drastically wrong, and we wonder how we'll recover. I took great heart and lessons from his experience because you couldn't have been knocked farther to the ground. I mean, he was really flattened by the experience that happened the first year of the war, World War I. The Western Front is going nowhere. It's total stalemate. He decides to open a second front, an Eastern Front, and that turns out to be just as much a disaster. But because he's aggressively out front trying to turn the tide of the war, when things go wrong, all the fingers point at him. And he's stripped of his posts in the government. He's reduced to just a minor figure in a matter of weeks. And he thinks his career at age 40 is over for good, and so does everyone else. But as I said earlier, he's got this sense of not only destiny, but also resiliency, and he simply will not accept what everyone else thought was fact, that he was washed up, finished. And he does something extraordinary. He decides he will go fight as an ordinary soldier at the Western Front. If he can't lead armies, he'll at least fight with them. It's sort of like if things had been going wrong in the Iraq War and Donald Rumsfeld, as Secretary of the Defense, decided to accept all responsibility for it, and the next you heard he had resigned and was leading a platoon in Iraq. Well, that's Churchill. We wouldn't see that with any modern politician today. He was the sort of person who, if he sent people into war, would risk his life alongside of them. And he did that very dramatically in World War One.
You use the word in the book overconfidence, and I guess that's both a plus and a minus for him, right? I mean, that overconfidence is partially what got him in the trouble in the first place, but it's also what got him out of it.
Failure is a great teacher, and I think he learned from failure. It's not a good teacher if you don't learn from it, but he learned from it. And there's a reason why he's the one indispensable man in 1940 when Britain is standing alone against Hitler, and he's the one who steps up and says, you know, we'll fight him on the beaches, we'll do whatever we have to do. And I think Hitler at that time was intimidated by this old bulldog. He knew Churchill's history, because the Germans had followed it closely from World War One. They were afraid of Churchill. He was quite a force. And I think he was the unique individual who history had reserved for us to stand up to probably the most evil man in the world. And by the time he was in his 60s, Hitler didn't look that forbidding to him, because he'd seen so much, including incredible moments of failure.
Because of that overconfidence, and we can use the word ego, certainly, when the press says that this man is a danger to this country, how does he react to that?
He knows it's not true, but I think most politicians develop a thick skin. It's just the problem with developing a thick skin is sometimes you don't see even the important criticisms. You just repel everything. He was the sort of man who could take criticism and still think about it and consider whether he had truly been wrong or not. He did learn from his mistakes. And I think, though people saw him as sometimes dangerous because he was willing to take risks, sometimes risks are necessary, and certainly there couldn't have been a greater risk-taking than the one of standing up to Hitler after all of Europe had fallen at his feet. I mean, the Germans were forming 17 miles from the English coast and, to all appearances, getting ready to invade. And Churchill essentially says, come on, we'll fight you. And no one else was willing to do that at the head of the government.
One of the things I took from the book is that I found fascinating was that there was this cadre of people who sort of went along with him for the ride, that there was trust in the people around him had in him, that while he was going through this, he certainly had his, as you stated, he certainly had his enemies, but he also had his friends who stayed with him for the long haul.
All leaders have to inspire, and he inspired a lot of people. His critics were so noisy and so vociferous that they were loudly heard. Sometimes his friends were silenced by all the noise around him. But they followed him, in some cases, very loyally. They believed in him. It's a dangerous thing, this kind of cult of personality, and I want to say that wasn't what Churchill had. It was never a cult. It was simply a feeling that he was the right man for the right time. And we know that history proved that to be the case. You don't get people like Churchill very often. You don't get people who have a sense of humility, but also have extraordinary egos. You don't get people who've known terrible failure, but also reaching for the stars. That's the kind of person he was. So he wasn't perfect, but he had something in his character that was just extraordinary.
A lesser question, but I'm curious where you were in the process of writing this biography when you decided to label him a young titan.
Really, it was almost toward the end, because I was trying to think of a way to sum up neatly what he represented in that period. And I thought, you know, sometimes he was like a kind of young prince or a god in mythological terms. He thought of himself certainly acting on some huge epic scale. And I just thought Titan was perfect for it. We usually sometimes use that word for business leaders.
Right.
He was leading a whole nation, and I think he was doing it like a young Titan in his 30s out of some incredible old story, and I felt almost as though I'd uncovered an old book people had forgotten about with this story already written under the title Young Titan.
Well, this is certainly a memorable portrait and a really incredible chapter of history, and I just found it fascinating. It's Young Titan, The Making of Winston Churchill. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Michael Sheldon, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Best of luck with the book and future work as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very nice to have you aboard. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Young Titan, The Making of Winston Churchill. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.